This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton, and here comes episode number 48 of Night Transmissions. If you ever have a bad day, I mean a really bad day, I mean a Jack Bauer sort of bad day. Starts off with your wife, having a fight with your wife, then you go out, you're kind of ticked off, and you accidentally kill somebody. And pretty soon, somebody's trying to blackmail you. Now, of course, that means you gotta kill them, too. And you know, before you know it, they're shooting at you. That's the kind of day Martin Wheeler's having in this episode of The Inner Sanctum from July 18th of 1946. I wasn't born yet, but I would be soon.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. Welcome once again through the squeaking door. So brave of you to drop in. You know, I do like to have a body around. It keeps me in good spirits. Hey, what's that? Oh, you feel warm. Well, now that may be the fault of the chairs. You see, we've been redecorating, and the chairs you're sitting in are hot seats. We bought them cheap from a firm that builds them for prisons. The convicts didn't like them. Now, they complained that everyone who sits in those chairs gets absolutely burned alive. And now, friends, draw up those chairs we talked about earlier and listen to tonight's tale of terror written especially for the Inner Sanctum by Michael Sklar. Our star tonight is Santa Sortega, who acts the role of Martin Wheeler in a blood-chilling story entitled, I Want to Report a Murder.
Other women don't have to put up with such treatment.
The way she carried on, you'd think I was Clark Gable. Instead of a middle-aged bank cashier getting bald and a little pot-bellied. I'd never given her any reason to be jealous, not in 20 years of married life. But she saw green every time I mentioned another woman. Every time I went out of the house. Like tonight.
That was the reason the last time. You've always got a reason for going out and leaving me here alone. Now you've got to practice for the bank employees' bowling tournament. That's a likely story.
It happens to be the truth, Margaret.
Oh, I'm sure the team will be practicing over the bowling alleys. And I'm just as sure you won't be there.
Where else would I be?
Oh, now you needn't pretend, Martin. I know you've got a date with one of those women.
I've told you 100 times I don't have any dates with any other women. And I'm sick and tired of your insane suspicions.
Insane, are they?
Yes, they are. I'll be home at 11 o'clock. You can wait up for me if you like. Good night. I went down to the car and began to drive to the bowling alleys. Margaret, always nagging at me. Someday she'd push me too far. Yes, someday if she didn't stop the nagging, there would be another woman. I stopped the car for a red light. There's a girl crossing the street. I noticed that she was blonde and pretty. A little like Margaret had looked when we were first married. And suddenly, as the girl passed in front of the car, she slipped and fell to the ground. What happened? Are you all right?
That hole in the street. I tripped.
Let me help you to your feet.
Oh, my foot. I must have sprained it.
Can you walk?
Well, I'll try. Oh, no. No, I can't put any weight on it.
Oh, that's too bad. Look here, let me drive you home.
Oh, I don't like to impose, but I...
It's not an imposition. I'd consider it a pleasure. She was about 25 years old and married. She said her name was Mrs. Susan Holmes. I didn't tell her my name. And as things turned out, that was lucky. No one was home at her apartment. I helped her to a chair and
started to leave.
Don't go yet. Come here. Oh, don't be afraid of me. I'm not going to bite you.
Mrs. Holmes, I've got an appointment at the bowling alley.
Well, that's not very flattering. Don't you like me?
Yeah, sure. I do, but... Mrs. Holmes, please, don't. You shouldn't.
Don't be silly. You've been very kind. And I like you.
Her arms were around my neck, pulling me down toward her. She used a faint perfume. Margaret hardly ever used perfume. Margaret. I thought of her as Susan kissed me. Then I stopped thinking until the door opened.
Say, what is this?
Robert! Susan! Who is...
I come home and find my wife kissing another guy. How long has this been going on?
Well, this is all a mistake. Your wife tripped and hurt her ankle. I brought her home and...
You won't weasel out of this by blaming it all on Susan. It won't work, mister. I saw both of you.
Mr. Holmes, I've tried to explain. You won't listen to me, so I'm leaving.
No, you don't.
Get out of my way.
This gun is loaded, mister.
Put that gun back in your pocket. Don't be a fool.
You're staying here and...
No. Hey, let go of my arm! Let go of that gun! I'll kill you for this.
Let go of the gun. I'll break your arm.
Now, I've got the gun.
Give it back to me.
I won't.
Stop it.
Look at the gun!
I had to take the gun away from him.
Oh.
I didn't mean to pull the trigger. Was he?
He's dead. You killed him.
I killed a man. I had to get away quick before the police came. Guess I could walk out of the door and forget the whole thing. Mrs. Holmes didn't know anything about me, nor even my name. I acted fast. I could get away. Go straight to the bowling alley and pretend it never happened.
Where are you going?
I'm leaving. Margaret, what are you doing here?
I've been waiting for you.
Checking up on me.
Why shouldn't I? It didn't take you this long to drive over from the house. Where have you been?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Margaret, leave me alone. Why are you staring at me?
Your face.
What about my face?
Lipstick. So that's why you took so long to get here?
Margaret, not so loud.
And you swore you'd never have dates with other women. Oh, I knew it. I knew it all the time.
Don't shout like that. People are staring.
Let them stare. Let him hear every word I say. I want your friends to know what kind of a man you are.
Phone call for Mr. Wheeler. Mr. Wheeler.
Heard that phone call. It must be for me. I'll be right back. Hello?
Mr. Wheeler?
Yes, who's this?
This is Susan Holmes, Mr. Wheeler.
What?
You killed my husband. Just in case you've already forgotten.
Huh? How did you know my name? Where to find me?
It was all in your wallet.
My wallet?
It dropped out of your pocket during the fight.
What? You want?
I gotta see you. Right away.
Well, that's impossible. My wife...
Would you rather have me call the police?
No. Don't do that, please. Where shall I meet you?
Downstairs, in front of my apartment house. I'll be there waiting for you.
I'll be there in 10 minutes. Bye.
Who's that phone call from?
No one you know, Margaret.
I can tell from the expression on your face. It was that woman again.
I can't argue with you, Margaret. I've got to go.
Go where?
I can't tell you.
You're going back to her?
No.
I won't stand for it. I won't be humiliated. If you go to her, I'll kill you. I swear I'll kill you.
To leave her there crying. What else could I do? She wouldn't have believed what happened any more than Holmes did. Even less. Because she was so jealous. Susan's voice had sounded hard and bitter over the phone. Well, I couldn't blame her. It's a rotten thing I did. Running away like that. Then I saw her waiting at the curb. Young... slim. And pretty.
So you came.
Get into the car, Susan. I want to tell you, I'm sorry about running away.
Save the apology. Let's start driving.
We drove for a while in silence. Several times I tried to start a conversation, but you wouldn't answer. Finally, I parked at the end of a deserted street on the waterfront. Fog was rolling in from the water. A few minutes, the mist would close around us.
I've been thinking. I decided what we're going to do. You don't want the police mixed up in this, do you?
No, of course not.
Oh, neither do I. And don't ask me why. I got my own good reason.
You got a plan?
Yeah. My husband subleased the apartment under an assumed name. We've only been there a few weeks. Nobody in the house knows it. I'll leave town for good. The police won't be able to trace either of us.
But your husband's body...
I'll leave it. That'll give me at least a couple of days' start before the police find it. You'll have to help me. I need money.
How much?
$5,000.
That's a lot of money.
You got a nerve squawking about money. After what you did.
It was self-defense.
How would you like to tell that to a jury?
But I simply haven't got $5,000.
There was a card in your wallet that showed you work in a bank. The bank got plenty of money. You know how to get it. And more, too.
She wanted me to steal the money. It's all clear now. No longer young and fresh and pretty. Just the cheap, flashy woman who wanted money. Money? It was blackmail. If she got the 5,000, it wouldn't end there. She'd keep riding me, squeezing me, milking me.
Well, which is it going to be? The money or the police?
Neither.
Ah, don't be stupid. There's a law against murder.
I'm going to do something very sensible, Susan.
What do you mean?
You...
Take your hands off my throat.
I don't like to do this.
Don't you joking me? No. No.
My fingers tightened on the throat. And I felt as though I was killing something inside me. She kissed me once. She said she liked me. And for a moment, I felt young again. Her body went limp suddenly between my hands. She was dead. I was a double murderer.
You know, I'm really annoyed at that Martin Wheeler, the ungrateful scoundrel, and that poor kid Susan Holmes. She got her neck twisted, all because she was trying to do Martin a good turn. That wasn't a good return for her pains, was it? But on the other hand, it's not hard to see Martin's point of view. He probably felt that one good turn deserved another. Now, let's return to Martin Wheeler, the middle-aged bank cashier, who's having a night full of trouble. A moment ago, he killed Susan Holmes because she threatened to tell the police about the death of her husband.
Fog was all around me now, making the world unreal. Sinister. Off in the water, the fog whistles were sobbing. I stood at the end of a pier, body of Susan in my arms. I held her a moment longer than was necessary. And then dropped her into the water. It was all over. I could go back to Margaret. Try to forget that I had committed murder. Then I remembered my wallet. My wallet. It contained my driver's license with my name and address on it. Back in the car, I found a handbag. It contained a change purse, the key to her apartment, but not my wallet. The wallet must still be in her apartment. I thought that I had it. Drove wildly, disregarding the fog, passing through red lights. Then a car loomed up in front of me. I slammed on the brakes and stopped, bumper to bumper. A man got out of the car in front of me. He wore a uniform. I'd almost hit a police car.
All right, what's your race, mister?
I didn't see the stop sign, the fog.
You were doing at least 40 miles an hour and on a city street, too. Driving like that on a night like this, you could kill somebody. What's your hurry?
Nothing at all. I just wanted to get home to my wife.
Let's have a look at your license.
My driver's license? It's in my wallet.
Get it out.
I lost my wallet the other day. License and all. I haven't had a chance to apply for a new one.
What's your name?
Martin Wheeler.
Where do you live?
63½ Sunset Drive.
And you say your wife is at home, huh?
Yes, sir.
All right, move over. We'll drive over to your house. Your wife will have to identify you.
Is that all, officer?
All except for this. Here's your ticket, Wheeler. Appear in traffic court tomorrow morning. And apply for a new license, you understand?
Yes, sir, I'll do that.
All right. And don't let me catch you driving like that again. Good night.
Good night.
Well, Martin?
I'm sorry, Margaret.
You're sorry. Who is she? What's her name?
Believe me, this isn't like what it's
been. Are you in love with her? Are you? Answer me.
No, I don't love her. Someday I'll be able to tell you what happened, but not now. I'm awfully tired. Let's go to bed. I pretended to sleep. The thought of my wallet still in Susan's apartment kept spinning through my mind. I had to get out of the house. I had to get to Susan's apartment and find the wallet. I couldn't leave until I was sure Margaret was asleep. She was asleep now. I slipped out of bed, got into my clothes, crept toward the door. I didn't see the chair in the dark until I stumbled open it.
Who's there? Martin? Martin, where are you?
I used the key I found in Susan's purse to let myself into her apartment. The body was no longer on the living room floor. She must have dragged it away. Perhaps she put it in the closet before she went to meet me. I didn't look for the body. My first concern was my wallet. And I found it where she must have left it, on the telephone table. Everything was there. $2, my license. I put it into my pocket, started to leave.
Wait a minute.
Holmes! I thought you were dead.
I'm still very much alive, Mr. Wheeler.
What the fight, the gunshot? You fell to the floor. Susan said you were dead. You're not even wounded. I don't understand. The gun. It must have been loaded with blanks.
That's right.
But why? Why didn't you tell me? Why did you let me go on thinking that... Oh, I think I understand now. It was the old badger game right from the beginning. Susan sprained ankle. When she kissed me, when you came in on us, that was all arranged in advance.
Oh,
I thought she really liked me, but it was all done in order to blackmail me. And now she...
Where is she?
I don't know.
She met you to arrange for the money. Now, you've got her door key. What did you do to her?
Nothing.
You don't kid me, Wheeler. I can figure out what happened. She met you and asked for the money according to plan, but you figured you could get out of the mess by killing her. That's what you did.
No.
Sure you did. Else, how could you get the door key? She wouldn't give it to you. Why would you come back here for the wallet? You better be on the level with me, Wheeler.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. So you killed her. But I don't hold it against you. Level with me and we'll make a deal.
What do you want?
So you did kill her.
Yes.
So it's a real thing now, instead of a phony. but the price is still the same. I'll keep my mouth shut for $5,000.
He was right. The situation was still the same. If I got the money for him, I'd be in his grip forever. It was his life or mine. I had no choice. But I needed a weapon. And I saw it on the desk. A sharp pointed leather knife. All right. I'll give you the money.
When?
Right now. I'll sit down at the desk and write you a check.
You're doing the smart thing, Wheeler. Yeah, you... That knife. Stay away from me.
Some money. Oh, no. No, no. Wheeler.
He was dead. I killed him twice in one night. This time, I made sure he was dead. Then I wiped my fingerprints off the knife, wiped the doorknob clean, then left the apartment. I thought of everything. I left nothing behind that might connect me with the two murders. Going home, I concentrated on one thought. I must forget this night. Erase it from my memory. If I ever thought of this night again, it would be as a nightmare. Our bedroom was still dark as I entered. Margaret must have gone to sleep. Felt good to be home again, safe. Back in a world where such things as I've done simply didn't happen. Someday, I tell Margaret the truth. Someday when we were old, such things no longer mattered. And then the room exploded in my face.
Oh, oh, Margaret. Don't. Don't, please don't. You're making a mistake. Margaret, you wouldn't let me...
I don't need any explanation. You went back to her. I told you I'd kill you if you went back to that woman.
Number, please.
Operator, get me the police. I want to report a murder.
Surprise, friend. Hmm? Oh, you were. Well, anyway, that ending certainly was a surprise for Martin Wheeler. You might say it was curtains for Martin. As you know, come to think of it, he made one big mistake. He shouldn't have murdered that nice Holmes couple. Mm-mm. No, indeed. He should have murdered his wife. Then we might have had a happy ending.
If you never saw the green grass anymore, 'cause it's covered up by litter from the folks there before you, what would you do? What would you do if you never saw the sky, or the soot that's in your eye, or the garbage piled so high? What would you do?
You've got to pitch in to clean up America. You've got to pitch in to clean up America. 'Cause if everybody won't pitch in to clean up America, it won't be America anymore.
Oh, no.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Staley Fleming's Hallucination by Ambrose Bierce. Of two men who were talking, one was a physician. "I sent for you, doctor," said the other, "but I don't think you can do me any good. Maybe you can recommend a specialist in psychopathy. I fancy I'm a bit loony." "You look all right," the physician said. "You shall judge. I have hallucinations. I wake up every night and see in my room, intently watching me, a big black Newfoundland dog with a white forefoot." "You say you wake. Are you sure about that? Hallucinations are sometimes only dreams." "Oh, I wake all right. Sometimes I lie still a long time, looking at the dog as earnestly as the dog looks at me. I always leave the light going. When I can't endure it any longer, I sit up in bed, and nothing is there." "Hmm. What is the beast's expression?" "It seems to me sinister. Of course I know that, except in art, an animal's face in repose has always the same expression. But this is not a real animal. Newfoundland dogs are pretty mild-looking, you know. What's the matter with this one?" "Really, my diagnosis would have no value. I am not going to treat the dog." The physician laughed at his own pleasantry, but narrowly watched his patient from the corner of his eye. Presently, he said, "Fleming, your description of the beast fits the dog of the late Atwell Barton." Fleming half rose from his chair, sat again, and made a visible attempt at indifference. "I remember Barton," he said. "I believe he was... It was reported that... Wasn't there something suspicious in his death?" Looking squarely now into the eyes of his patient, the physician said, "3 years ago, the body of your old enemy, Atwell Barton, was found in the woods near his house and yours. He had been stabbed to death. There have been no arrests. There was no clue. Some of us had theories. I had one. Have you?" "I? Why, bless your soul, what could I know about it?" "You remember that I left for Europe almost immediately afterward, a considerable time afterward. In the few weeks since my return, you could not expect me to construct a theory. In fact, I have not given the matter a thought. What about his dog?" "It was the first to find the body. It died of starvation on his grave." We do not know the inexorable law underlying coincidences. Staley Fleming did not, or he would perhaps not have sprung to his feet as the night wind brought in through the open window the long, wailing howl of a distant dog. He strode several times across the room in the steadfast gaze of the physician. Then, abruptly confronting him, almost shouted, "What has all this to do with my trouble, Dr. Halderman? You forget why you were sent for." Rising, the physician laid his hand upon his patient's arm and said gently, "Pardon me. I cannot diagnose your disorder offhand. Tomorrow, perhaps. Please go to bed, leaving your door unlocked. I will pass the night here with your books. Can you call me without rising?" "Yes, there is an electric bell." "Good. If anything disturbs you, push the button without sitting up. Good night." Comfortably installed in an armchair, the man of medicine stared into the glowing coals and thought deeply and long, but apparently to little purpose, for he frequently rose and, opening a door leading to the staircase, listened intently, then resumed his seat. Presently, however, he fell asleep, and when he woke it was past midnight. He stirred the failing fire, lifted a book from the table at his side, and looked at the title. It was Denecker's Meditations. He opened it at random and began to read. "Forasmuch as it is ordained of God that all flesh bath spirit, and thereby taketh on spiritual powers, so also the spirit bath powers of the flesh, even when it is gone out of the flesh and liveth as a thing apart, as many a violence performed by wraith and lemur sheweth. And there be who say that man is not single in this, but the beasts have the like evil inducement." And the reading was interrupted by a shaking of the house, as by the fall of a heavy object. The reader flung down the book, rushed from the room, and mounted the stairs to Fleming's bedchamber. He tried the door, but contrary to his instructions, it was locked. He set his shoulder against it with such force that it gave way. On the floor near the disordered bed, in his nightclothes, lay Fleming, gasping away his life. The physician raised the dying man's head from the floor and observed a wound in the throat. "I should have thought of this," he said, believing it suicide. When the man was dead, an examination disclosed the unmistakable marks of an animal's fangs deeply sunken into the jugular vein. But there was no animal. End of Staley Fleming's Hallucination by Ambrose Bierce.
Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. Look, I'm just gonna play some music, okay? The other day, I was talking to my brother, Bill. Yeah, my brother, William Raymond Clinton. The William Raymond part was the hospital's idea. My mother wanted to call him Billy Ray, and so, growing up, we all called him Billy Ray. I may get a bop on the head for telling you that, but I don't really think so. My brother Bill is pretty cool about these things. I wonder if William Jefferson Clinton was ever called Billy Jeff or Willie Jeff. Living in Hope, Arkansas, I'll bet he was. Anyway, the conversation between myself and my brother came around, as it sometimes does, to this show. And he began to talk about a radio program that he remembered listening to 25 or 30 years ago that he'd been very impressed with. He remembered the name, the thing on the foreboard board, and he remembered the plot, and he remembered how much he liked it, saying that he just couldn't remember anything as tightly written where every word counts as much as it did in this old radio play. Well, a little time later, and after a little research on the internet, I discovered that the thing on the foreboard board was a play from Quiet Please, that aired on August the 8th of 1948. Brother Bill was right. This is an excellent piece of radio drama. So much so that, well, you're going to hear it next. Keep listening.
Quiet, please. The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet Please for tonight is called The Thing on the Foreboard Board. Me, I'm a roughneck. Well, I was a roughneck, 20 years ago, a little too old, too slow now. Besides, I got a dollar now, I don't have to be a roughneck, you see. Married, got a nice home, had to meet my wife. Hey, Mike! Her name's Maxine, but she likes to be called Mike. Mike! I guess she's busy out in the kitchen someplace. Besides, she doesn't hear very well. Shame, too, she's so pretty and everything. Well, you'll meet her. Sit down. I was saying I was a roughneck. Well, no, that doesn't mean exactly what you think it means. A roughneck is an oil field worker, specifically a guy in a drilling crew. Call them roughnecks like you call a section hand on the railroad a gandy dancer, a garage hand a grease monkey. Same time you work around a drilling crew for a while, you're going to be a roughneck in every sense of the word, boy. A derrick floor or a foreboard board's no place for a guy with a bow tie. Because... and when you have to fool around with drilling holes that go farther down the ground than it is from the top of Pike's Peak down to sea level. Yeah, sure they do. By the time I was a roughneck, we'd got this one well down to 7,313 feet. That was a record. But last May, Pure Oil brought one in out in the Natrona Valley in Wyoming at 14,309 feet. That, friend, is almost 3 miles. Quite a hole, that, huh? Sure, I don't think there's an oil man in the world that don't wonder one time or another what's down there, besides rock and oil and gas. Oil that's made out of trees that died 20 million years ago. Oil that's made out of dinosaur bones. Oil that's maybe made out of the flesh and blood of men, maybe, that beat each other to death with a stone axe, ate saber-toothed tiger for lunch. Hey, get to wondering. You look at the cores that come up from way down there, and sometimes the little shells, trilobites mostly, that was alive when Manhattan Island, where New York is, was under half a mile of ice. We found something once, me and Billy Grunewald, and something found us. I'll tell you about it. We were down to around 5,400 feet. We'd set casing. We began to get water, so we had to stop drilling and cement off. Well, you see, when water begins to seep in the hole, you pull your drill pipe, then you let down a cementing shoe inside the casing, and you plug up the bottom of the hole, casing and all, with quick-hardening waterproof cement. Then when it's hard, you drill through the cement, go on down, and the cement outside the casing at the bottom keeps the water out. Well, we had the drill pipe all pulled and cracked. The cement was setting, see? So we was shut down, waiting for it to harden. We'd been coring just before. Well, you see, a core drill is hollow. And as the bit digs down, it stuffs the drillings up inside it. So when you pull it out, you got a sample of the kind of stuff you're going through. And a geologist can tell a lot from that. So there's nobody around the rig except me that night. The rest of the crew's gone into town. I was toasting some pork chops over the forge for myself, but I heard a car pulling up. Look out, it's Billy Grunewald, the geologist, and I give him a hello. Hi, Billy, come and have a pork chop.
Hi, Porky. Where's everybody?
They all went to town, I'm the whole crew.
Yeah, I had 3 blowouts between here and Oxnard.
Yeah, I wondered where you was. Ted said you'd be in here about 3.
Yeah, I would have been, except for my tough luck. Oh, boy, I'm dead.
Yeah, hungry?
Starved.
Yeah, I got 7 pork chops. And bread. And some coffee, kind of.
Swell. Hey, I got a bottle in the car.
We're going to have a banquet.
Hey, where's that core? That's what I came up here to look at.
Yeah, back there on the bench. Look at it after supper.
Hey.
What?
Didn't you say you were all alone here? I thought I heard somebody talking.
I don't see anybody. Keep an eye on that pork chop. You won't have any supper.
Yeah, I'm watching it.
Yeah, let me put the coffee on. Like so.
When did you finish cementing?
This morning. Last tower only made about 10 feet of hole, so Ted shut down before we get flooded out of house and home.
Funny about that water.
How?
Oughtn't to be any at that level, according to my figuring.
Well, there is.
Is it salt?
Sure, right out of the bottom of the ocean.
That's funny. Well, maybe I'll be able to tell something from the core. Yeah, I hope so. The last core I looked at, I'd have sworn we were getting into shale.
Ain't seen none yet from the cuttings.
That's funny.
Here, your pork chop's done. Yeah, take some bread.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, man.
Good, huh? And put on another. I had 2 already before you come.
Yeah, much obliged. Yeah, you know, you never can tell what's down there. You get it all mapped and plotted out, all the strata. And all you know is what comes out of the hole.
Yeah. I'd like to go down there sometime if I was little enough.
Never get you down a hole.
Yeah, you'd fit. You're skinny.
I'll stay up here and look at the cores, bud. Where is that one?
Behind you. Over there.
Hmm? Oh. Well, I'll have a look at it.
Why don't you wait to finish your supper?
I'm just going to look at it. Put on another pork chop for me.
Okay.
Well, I wish I was screech out of it.
What's the matter?
Hey, wait a minute, Porky.
Well, why do you...
Listen.
What's eating you?
You know, I'd have sworn there's somebody up there in that Forville board.
Ah, you're crazy. There's nobody up there.
You're going to get those stands of drill pipe.
Ah, they're just rack crooked. One of them slipped. Come on back and eat your pork chop.
Yeah, I guess so. Only I...
What you so jittery about, Billy? Come on, eat your sandwich. Here.
Yeah, well, thanks, Porky. I don't know. I'm just naturally that way, I guess. I'm always scared of the dark.
I'm scared.
Doggone it, I hate to be a baby, but I can't help it.
Scared of the dark? Honest?
Stupid, ain't it?
Oh, I don't know. Everybody's scared of something. Me? Spiders scare the tar out of me. Black widows. Oh. I know how you feel, Billy.
There another light over here?
Yeah. Here.
Ah. Oh. That's better. Hey, listen, Porky. Go out to the car and look in the left-hand door pocket and bring back that bottle, will you? That's what I need.
Okay, kid. Okay. So I picked up a flashlight. I turned around and went outside. I found the car. And I got the bottle. And the floor of the derrick was all lit up, and when I saw a beam of light suddenly flash up toward the foble board, I laughed. Billy Grunewald and his ideas. Sure, I looked up. There wasn't a darn thing up there, except the drill pipe racked against the fingerboard. Oh, this foble board. Well, you've seen oil derricks, or pictures of them? You know that little platform that runs around the outside of the derrick about halfway up? Well, that's the foble board. Well, you see, drill pipe comes in lengths, and you handle them with several lengths screwed together so as to save time getting them in and out of the hole. Two lengths is a double, three is a triple, four is a foble. When you pull the pipe, you hoist it up inside the derrick of the traveling block, which moves up and down from the crown block at the top of the derrick. Then when a foble of pipe is pulled out, it's held in the rotary table. You break the joint with tongs, like a great big stilts and wrench, you see. Snub a cable that's fastened to the handle over the cat head on the draw works, and that breaks the joint. Then you hold the tongs on the pipe, give the rotary table a few turns to unscrew it. You heist away with the traveling block and swing it over against the fingerboard, lean it against the derrick. The guy up on the foble board takes off the traveling block. You do it all over again, and you got all the pipe out, you see? Well, there wasn't anybody up on the foble board, except a screech owl, and it flew away. So Billy turned his light off, and I come on inside. And just as I come up the steps, he let out a yell.
Yay!
What's the matter? What's the matter, Billy?
Hey, come here. Look here.
Well, what's it?
Look, Porky.
Mike. Where did you find that?
Now, listen, Porky, I give you my word. That was embedded in the core.
Why, it couldn't be.
I tell you, it was. Look where I dug it out. You know what? That rock there comes from a mile underground. And it's been a mile underground for a million years. And look at this.
And I did look. And what he was holding was a gold ring. And it was all carved and filigreed just like jewelry. And there wasn't any kidding about it. It was real. Now, wait a minute. Hang on. I ain't done. I poked at the core of rock that looked like a kind of petrified salami or something. And then it was my turn to pretty near jump out of my pants. Because right alongside the place where Billy dug out the ring, there was a mud-covered, but very unmistakable, finger. I picked it up, and it was cold, and it was heavy. And it was solid rock. At least it felt like solid rock. And I looked at Billy, and Billy looked at me. He started to rub the mud off this here stone finger. And as he rubbed it, it began to disappear. No, he could still feel it, he said, but when the mud was gone, neither one of us could see it. And he dropped it to the derrick floor. It went clunk, and we couldn't find it any place. So you know what we done. We took that bottle and we took and finished it, Billy and me. We finished it in one slug apiece, and it was a full pint of bathtub gin. It tasted just like so much well water to me. And then we sat down on the derrick floor and we looked at each other. We didn't say a word. My eyes got heavier and heavier. The last thing I remember was I heard some kind of noise that seemed to be coming up from down the foble board 80 feet above us. I shut my eyes a minute. I guess I went to sleep. And I had all awful dreams. Black Widow. Spiders crawling all over me with gold rings on their legs. Things I could hear but I couldn't see. Up on the floorboard. Billy Grunewald climbing up the ladder outside the derrick in the moonlight. Faces looking at me, and I couldn't figure out who they were. Then I was waked up by a horrible scream. The crash came inside me that shook the whole derrick. I opened my eyes to see Billy Grunewald lying on the floor 2 feet away with a broken neck. With a broken neck and his left hand. Well, he put the gold ring on the little finger of his left hand, and the way his arms were spread out, his left little finger and the ring were gone. Well, friend, I got out of there. I ran down to where Billy had left his car, and I got in. I stepped on the starter. And I couldn't get it to go, and then I remembered after I'm pretty near run down the battery that Billy had taken a key. I wasn't going up there and go through a dead man's clothes to get it. So I sat there in the car and shivered all by myself till daylight. And then Ted and the crew came. Afterwards, a state cop and everybody in the world was asking me questions.
Did you and Billy have a fight, Porky?
I told you we didn't, Ted.
But you had been drinking.
We only had that little pipe, Ted.
Well, what was he doing over in the floorboard?
Did you threaten him, and did he run up there to get away from
Listen,
you?
Listen, cop, don't be a chump. Billy Grunewald and I were good friends.
Then why'd you push him off the floorboard?
I didn't, I tell you. I wasn't up there.
Well, what did he go up there for?
I don't know. I was asleep.
How do you know he was up there?
I didn't say he was. You said so. Besides, how would he break his neck if he didn't fall from way up there?
Well, look, officer. I think it was just another accident. I mean, we haven't got anything on Porky, and personally, I don't believe he did it.
Well, it's mighty mysterious.
So it is. But we got work to do. Now, how about it? That cement's hard down there. I want to start drilling again, and I'm short-handed. Will you let Porky stay here till I run in me pipe again? And, well, then you can take him and ask him questions till you're blue in the face.
Well,
okay. Let's get rolling. You got steam up, Hoppy?
I'm a little fast.
All right. Porky, you go from the floorboard.
What? Not me, Ted.
Oh, don't be such a boob. There's nobody up there to shove you overboard. Now, you can put a safety line around you if you want to. And besides, you'll get him paid to do what you're told. I've lost too much time already. Come on, get going.
So, okay, I go up on the floorboard. And you can bet I took a good gander around before I did anything else. Now I couldn't see a thing. So I signaled to the driller to let down the traveling block, and he did. Came sailing down from up above. I was just reaching for it to pick up the first forbola drill pipe. Gave a big jerk, and the cable broke. It dropped and nearly pulled me off the forbola board. And it landed right on top of Ted. And if you have any idea what a guy looks like after 2 tons of metal land on him from 80 feet up, yeah, you keep your ideas to yourself. Well, that was enough. 2 accidents in a row. The whole crew quit. They wasn't going to wait for a third. And it was Ted's money that was paying off. There wasn't any more, and as far as I know, the abandoned derrick is still there. And that was 20 years ago. Oh, I forgot to tell you something. That traveling block was right in front of my face when it broke loose. It was hanging by steel cable, 3/4-inch steel cable. And I saw that cable break right before my eyes. It looked just like a piece of string when you snap it between your fingers. I could almost see the fingers. You know what? There was something up there on the forble board with me. And so a couple of days later I came back. I don't know if there's anything in the world as desolate, as dismal, as dead-looking as an abandoned oil well rig. There it stands like a skeleton off on a deserted side road and the bare yellow hills surrounding it, and it's the deadest thing you ever saw. I sat in my car for a long time looking at it. Everything was just the way we'd left it. I looked into the floor. The smashed traveling block was there alongside the rotary table. There was a little mutter of steam from the boiler. That was all. Then I heard a tinkle of something as it hit the ground alongside me. I looked around. There wasn't a soul in sight. But at my feet was the gold ring that Billy Grunewald and I had found in a core of rock that came from a mile underground and from a million years ago in time. And I heard a little sound. The sound of a kid crying. And there wasn't any kid up there. And I heard it again, and it came from above my head, and I took out my revolver. I loaded it carefully. I started up the ladder to the foible board. Well, there wasn't anything up there, nothing I could see. There was a voice crying. The voice of a little kid. And then there was a movement behind the rack of drill pipes, and I saw the pipe move, and I yelled, "Come out of there, whoever you are! Come out or I'll start shooting!" And the stand of pipe shivered, and I thought, what can it be that can handle that heavy pipe like Jack Straw's? And then there was a crash. The whole stand of pipe fell over, and I just got out of the way in time. And I was alone on the foible board with the thing. But I couldn't see it. I felt the platform tremble under my feet again as something moved toward me. I fired two or three shots. And nothing happened. I started backwards. I knew it was following me because I could hear it meowing like a cat. My feet tripped over something. I saw it was a big can of red lead that somebody had left up there. Without thinking, I picked it up and I threw it at the sound and it splashed. There it was. And I wish... The face of a little girl, frightened, crying with hunger and terror. Hands like a human being and a finger missing from the left hand. And a body. I'll not tell you about that. I told you how I'm scared of spiders. But I knew where it came from. It had come from the bowels of the earth, come riding up on the drill pipe as we yanked it out of the well. Come to an alien world and was lost. It stood there dripping with red paint, blood red from head to foot like some horrible dream. And it put its hand on my arm. Its hand was stone. Living, moving stone. And it looked into my eyes and mewed like a lost kitten. No. 20 years ago, I discovered many things about it, what it used for food, that it was deaf, that it was invisible and couldn't see people when it was invisible. That if you sprayed it with mud or paint, or grease paint, makeup, then it could see people. And believe me, I didn't want to see its body. I can see that in my nightmares. But its face, I can't help wanting to see that pathetic little girl face. I'm afraid maybe I've fallen. But it's very beautiful. And when it's well made up, it's... But making it up, rubbing grease paint on a stone face that looks at you and smiles and it makes sounds like a lost kitten yet. I can disguise the body in long dresses. She can't hear very well. And when she's hungry, I have to stay out of her way. I found out what she likes to eat, remember? No, sit still. Sit still, do. Sit still or I'll have to shoot you. I want you to meet my wife. Or rather, my wife wants to meet you. Mike. Mike. There she is. Come on in, dear. The title of tonight's Quiet Please story is The Thing on the Furble Board. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper and featured Ernest Chappell. And Dan Sutter played Billy Grunewald. Pat O'Malley was Ted. And Cecil Roy was also a member of the cast. As usual, music for Quiet Please is played by Albert Berman. Sound? Sound by our good friend Albert April. And so, until next week at the same time, I am quietly yours, Ernest Chappell. This program is heard in Canada through the facilities of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Sometimes, Jed, I wish I'd never taken this job as sheriff.
I know what you mean.
Take today, Memorial Day. Everybody else is sitting around their house taking things easy-like.
Or else out boating or having a picnic.
That's right, enjoying themselves. But us, we're sitting around a stuffy old office.
Yep, waiting for something to happen, like vultures. I could think of a lot pleasanter things I'd rather...
I'll get it. Probably my wife. Green County Sheriff's Office. Who? Tom Edson's farm. Shot? Tom Edson shot by your wife? We'll be right out.
As you can see, Sheriff, my wife Edith is hysterical. She's in no condition to answer questions.
I didn't kill Dad. I didn't. You know I didn't, Ronald.
Jed.
Yep, Sheriff.
As soon as you finish that sketch and notes on the position of the body, you better call Doc Ferris.
That's a good idea. Edith should be placed under a doctor's care immediately. She's been building up to this collapse for some time.
You must believe me. I didn't kill Dad. I wasn't even in the house.
You weren't in the house?
No. I was in the stables talking to the horses when I heard the shots and ran back to the house.
Edith, darling, you know you were in the room kneeling by your father when I came into the house, weren't you?
Oh, yes, Ronald.
And you had the gun in your hand, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, Ronald, but I didn't kill Dad.
You see, Sheriff?
Looks bad.
Tom Edson never approved of Edith's marriage to me, Sheriff, and because of that, Edith and I had never been in here during the 10 years we've been married. This is our first visit.
I've called the doc, Sheriff. He'll be right out.
Good.
Oh, another thing, Sheriff. I noticed the automatic, the murder weapon, had a peculiar odor about it.
Did?
Yep. Smells something like powder or perfume.
Mm. It's Edith's gun. He carried it in her purse. You know how things in a woman's purse always smells like their face powder?
Yeah.
Edith and her father had been arguing all morning. Then when I heard the postman blow his whistle, you know how he blows a little whistle on these country routes when he leaves mail? Well, it was a relief to get out of the house. After I walked all the way out that long lane to the mailbox, there wasn't anything there but a couple of bills. While I was walking back, I heard shots and...
Ronald, how can you stand there and so calmly convict your own wife? Sheriff, I didn't kill my father.
I know you didn't, Edith. Now I know that Ronald is the murderer.
On what clues does the sheriff place his accusation that Ronald is the murderer? Do you know? We'll be back in 1 minute with the solution. In the meantime...
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back.
Now, back to our mystery.
Ronald, maybe mail doesn't mean much to you big city folks. You maybe don't pay much attention to its delivery. But we farmers appreciate our mail and know all about deliveries. You couldn't have heard the mailman's whistle and gone out for the mail, Ronald, because today is Memorial Day, a national holiday, and mail isn't delivered on national holidays. However, holiday or not, I'm going to deliver you to the county jail immediately.
Next up is a episode from Dimension X. Dimension X was a NBC radio program that never actually found a sponsor, and that may explain why it really didn't run too long. From April the 8th of 1950 to September 29th of 1951, for a total of, I think it was 39 episodes. The first 13 episodes were broadcast live, and the remainder were pre-recorded. Tonight's episode is No Contact. Originally aired on April the 9th of 1950. And it's a little bit different from most of the episodes that would run on Dimension X, in that it was an original production. Most of the episodes of Dimension X were actually adaptations of previously published science fiction stories, which gave the show a bit of a leg up over other science fiction being produced at the time. Not to say there was a lot, there really wasn't. Dimension X is regarded as the second regularly scheduled science fiction series, being preceded by only a few months by the more, I'd have to say, adolescent, although at times good fun, 2000 plus.
Adventures in Time and Space. Transcribed in future tense.
Dimension X.
Can you predict what will come in 100 years, or in 10, or in the next minute? Some people think they can. Nuclear scientists, mathematicians, astronomers, biologists, they'll predict the shape of the future. Why? Because they make the future. Because they see beyond the known dimensions of time and space into the unknown. Dimension X. It was in the year of 1982 that spacemen first discovered the Great Galactic Barrier. In the past 10 years, rocket travel to the moon and the nearer planets had become commonplace. And then men fixed their sights on a more distant star, the remote planet known as Volta. 5 exploratory ships went out, and none came back, each in turn disappearing mysteriously at the same vanishing point, at an invisible wall somewhere in the vast outer reaches that became known as the wrecker of spaceships. The Galactic Reef. And yet the explorers refused to admit defeat. It was on June the 2nd, 1987, that the rocket Star Cloud made ready for takeoff, the 6th to attempt to crack the barrier and win through to Volta.
Now hear this. Condition green. 2 minutes.
I don't suppose you want the ship's doctor up here on the bridge during Glasgow.
No, I think not, Smitty.
All right, then. I'll be in the sick bay counting vitamin pills if you need me. Good luck, Louis.
Thank you, Smitty. Lieutenant Collier.
Yes, sir.
You're relieved. You better get down to navigation control and take over.
Yes, sir.
Oh, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
we've never flown together before. This is your first flight in a space vessel as big as the Star Cloud, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
but I was trained in oversized jobs at the Naval Academy.
Well, if you're half as good a navigator as your father was, you'll do fine.
Thank you, sir. You were old shipmates, weren't you?
Old shipmates. I served under them in the first rocket that ever got back to its base in one piece. We flew that mission in a tin can not much better than a primitive guided missile. I almost went along on the last trip your father made to the barrier. Too bad about that.
Yes, sir.
Now, that's all, Collier. I'll bus you when you get down to nap control. Lieutenant Paulson.
Yes, sir.
Get me ground control tower on the radio. I want to talk to Colonel Harrison.
Sparks has the circuit up now, Captain. Go ahead, sir. I patched in our bridge speaker.
Colonel Harrison?
Yes, Captain?
We're standing by for takeoff in 60 seconds.
Good. The field is clear of all personnel. We'll try to reestablish radio contact immediately after takeoff. In any event, there'll be a 24-hour ground monitor.
Fine.
Good luck. I hope you make it.
Thank you. Bridge to navigation control.
Ground control, Collier.
Ready, Lieutenant?
We're ready, Captain. The course is in the integrator for takeoff at 1,200 hours.
All right. Stand by for blastoff. Bridge to engine room. Fire up your rocket chambers. Take off at exactly 1,200 hours. I'll read you off. 20 seconds. 19, 18, 17, 16.
Condition red.
Hold it.
Condition
please move red. Who turned in that alarm?
We uncovered a stowaway, sir.
Stowaway? Where, Masters?
Hiding in 6 Bay. Dr. Smithson found him.
Have him brought up to the bridge. Engine room, kill your rockets and stand by.
Harrison, this is Colonel Harrison of ground control. What's running you up?
Trouble.
What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with you? There's a stowaway aboard.
Stowaway?
Yes, I thought your men were supposed to police this base. What's the matter with you?
All right, Captain, take it easy.
You know what this delay can do to us, don't you? 1 minute later, takeoff can throw us a million miles off course. We'll have to reintegrate the whole work.
Well, look, how long do you think it'll take?
Don't bother me for a while. I'm busy.
Stupid idiot. Captain
Thorpe. Oh, come in, Smitty.
Here's your stowaway.
I'll court-martial the... Charlie.
Can you use a good radio man, Skipper?
See you two have met.
Met? The Skipper and me made 50 trips to the moon together. Didn't we, Captain?
Charlie, if you wanted to come along, why didn't you volunteer?
I did, Skipper. They turned me down.
What's wrong with you?
Acceleration bend.
Oh.
They said my arteries wouldn't stand another trip.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
But they're wrong, sir. I got one more good trip in me. Now listen, Captain. You know these green kids don't know the first thing about space radio operations. You put a man like me on, I'll be getting you a bedtime story for Mars.
Now listen, Charlie, you know the regulations as well as I do. I can't take you much as I'd like to.
Colonel Harrison will murder me for this.
Oh. I'm sorry, Charlie. I'll have to put you aground. I'll tell you what. I'll ask Harrison to put you on as ground radio contact. It'll seem as if you were right here with us.
He won't do it, sir.
He'd better, or I'll have him busted to corporal for letting you sneak aboard. Now, you'd better be off, Charlie. Masters.
Yes, sir.
I'm sending this man aground. Give him time to clear the launching platform.
Yes, sir.
So long, Charlie. I'm really sorry.
Good luck, Skipper.
I thought you were going to have him drawn and quartered.
If it'd been anybody else, I would have, Smitty. But Charlie, well, he's kind of special. Been with me since my first command, when we began the regular run to the moon. If he wanted to come along this time, well, it's only through loyalty to me.
You know, Lewis, I didn't realize it before, but you're almost human.
Bilge. Navigation, Lieutenant Collier, you there?
Captain Collier.
Lieutenant, how badly are we fouled up? Can you recalculate the course, or shall I cancel the takeoff?
I've already plotted a new course on the integrator, sir.
Good.
Can we take off in exactly 2 minutes?
2 minutes?
Yes, sir. If we can, all we need to correct is for only a 1 degree deflection. I can do that before we reach the stratosphere.
That's quick work. Are you sure?
Positive, sir.
Well, all right, Collier. I'm putting it in your hands. We'll blast off on your signal.
Lewis, isn't that a lot of responsibility for a young green officer?
Yes, but if he can't do his job, I'd rather find out now than at the galactic barrier. Bridge to engine room. Prepare to blast off on navigator signal. How are we doing, Collier?
Coming on the bearing, sir.
Four.
We've intersected the course vector.
Good work, Collier.
The course is corrected, sir. Ready to go into atomic overdrive anytime you say.
All right, stand by.
Now hear this. Now hear this. Prepare for maximum acceleration.
Bridge to engine room. Kill your rockets.
Rockets out.
Fire up number one cyclotron.
Yes, sir.
Fire up number two.
Number two ready.
Withdraw your dampening rods.
Aye. Ignition chamber ready. Glass tubes cleared. All generators operating at capacity, sir.
Right. Go into overdrive on the count of zero.
5 seconds, Captain.
Three.
Two.
Two.
One.
One.
Zero.
Zero. How are we doing, Collier?
On course, sir. She's running hot and true.
Well, my compliments, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir.
This job would have done your father credit. He was one of the best navigation officers I ever saw.
Thanks, sir.
Now start your gyros and put her on robot control. The bridge is yours, Mr. Collier. If you need me, I'll be in Dr. Smith's office.
Yes, sir.
Got us off the ground.
Yeah, you can thank young Collier for that. Chip off the old guard.
You knew his father?
Matter of fact, I knew him very well. First-rate spaceman.
Is he the one who...
Yes. He was lost in the galactic barrier on the second ship we sent up to Volta.
Lewis, just what do you think this galactic barrier is?
Your guess is as good as mine, Doc. All I know is that 5 ships have gone into it. None of them have come back out.
How about Miss Trubik's theory that it's a time warp in space, that the ships reach it and slip into another dimension?
Rubbish. My theory is that the galactic barrier is nothing more than a radioactive layer of some kind.
What makes you say that?
Well, we know that radar signals bounce off it like they were hitting an invisible glass wall. And we know that it destroys our ships and crews in some way. There's no other logical explanation.
What makes you think we can get through it, Lewis?
Because we're ready for it. The others weren't. The entire hull is completely shielded with lead. We can crack through any radioactive cloud ever detected. Besides, we're equipped with some new UHF radio devices that should enable us to maintain radio contact with Earth. Nothing can happen. Absolutely nothing.
Who are you trying to convince?
Myself, I suppose.
Lewis, you've had your share of glory. First skipper to reach the moon back in 1962.
Yeah.
You could have retired. Why are you risking this trip?
Because 5 ships are missing. And men like Prentice and Marketson and young Collier's father... I'm tired of seeing good men fed into that meat chopper.
Then why are we going?
We haven't any choice, Smitty. We're in a race, the kind of race where men and ships are expendable. According to Interspace Code, the First Nation to reach Volta can claim it.
Personally, I want no part of it.
Doc, there are a dozen nations who feel very differently about that.
I know. You're right, of course. Well, at least it won't be boring. I'll have to play physician morale builder and mother substitute for 112 slightly nervous men.
Your morale doesn't sound too good, Doc.
As morale officer, I can state without fear of contradiction, it is terrible. And something tells me that as we approach that galactic barrier, I'm not going to be alone.
Hello, Earth. Hello, Earth. Captain Thorson of the Star Cloud calling Earth. Star Cloud to Earth. Can you read me?
Hello, Star Cloud. Hi, Captain.
Charlie. Well, I see they haven't court-martialed you yet.
Oh, sir. Thanks to you.
That's good to hear you. You can read us the funny papers on Sunday morning.
Right.
How's our signal?
Strong. Clear as a bell.
Well, here's our log report for Colonel Harrison. Ready?
Shoot.
June 2nd, 1987. 4 weeks out from Earth. Running through. No radiation. Operation normal. Still making our approach to the galactic barrier. That's all, Charlie. See you later.
Good luck, Captain. I sure wish I was with you.
How's the morale, Smitty?
Well, the men know we're getting closer to the barrier. They're beginning to show a little tension, Lewis.
How's their physical condition? Any sickness?
About half the crew has come down with space blues.
I was afraid of that. Bad?
Oh, same as usual. Lips and hands with a bluish cast. Eyes are sensitive to infrareds.
I don't know. When I first started flying these tin cans, nobody ever heard of space blues.
There's a theory it's caused by the terrific acceleration of the atomic overdrive.
Hmm.
The change in gravity affects the circulation.
And what do you think?
Oh, I think it's psychosomatic. I've noticed that the same men who get space blues under tension on a ship tend to get blue coloration back on Earth when they're upset. I guess it's an occupational disease of space navigators.
You think it's just nerves, then?
I don't know.
Young Collier's got a bad case. Yes, I think it's tension from overwork.
Yeah. Maybe he needs some vitamins.
Lewis, when will you realize that vitamins are not a panacea for all the troubles of mankind?
Sir, I understand you've relieved me from duty.
Dr. Smithson says you aren't looking very well, Collier. I'm just giving you a rest.
But, sir, I feel perfectly able to continue.
Your lips are as blue as Minnetonka.
Captain, I'd like to remain at my post.
Now, don't be so foolhardy, Lieutenant.
I'm not being foolhardy, sir. You see, I have a special personal reason for wanting this expedition to reach Volta.
Your father?
Yes, sir, my father.
You think he might still be alive?
Sir, I have to find out what happened.
I think I understand. Very well, Collier. Report back to duty. What's the reading, Paul?
We're getting a +5 radar bounce now. Coming off the barrier almost as fast as we sent it out.
What's the interval?
3/10 of a second. Sure thing, sir. That's great. We'll hit the wall in the next few minutes.
All right. Alert the crew. Sound general quarters.
Now, here it is. Condition red. We are now approaching the galactic barrier. All hands to stations. All radiation detectors to be fully manned. Full security will prevail until further notice. That is all.
Boston.
Aye, sir.
Radar bounces up to +6. We'd better try to make final contact with Earth. Is Spark still trying to raise the base?
Yes, sir, but he's not having much luck. Seems to be some interference. Well, that's the radio room now. Yes? You've got him? Well, cut in on the bridge speaker. The captain will take it from here.
Hello. Star clouds to Earth. Can you hear me, Earth?
Hello, Skipper. I can barely read you. We're getting heavy static
from sunspots. That's not sunspots. We're right on the galactic barrier. Getting a +7 radar bounce. Expect to hit the barrier almost any second now.
Good luck, Skipper.
Look, Charlie, stick with us, will you? We're switching to the automatic center now so you can track us in.
Okay.
If we crack the barrier and come through still in one piece, I'll try to get back to you on the high frequency band.
Thank you, Skipper. Don't worry. I'll be waiting.
So long, Charlie.
So long, Starcross.
We must be getting awfully close now, Captain. Echo's bouncing back so fast, almost beating the signal.
Well, when they coincide, hold on to your hat. That's when we run into the wall.
Any second.
Hold on.
Here goes nothing.
Here it comes. What? Nothing happened.
We made it, Captain.
No radiation, no time!
Radioactivity. Is it the fission chambers?
No leak here, sir.
I'll check your gauges.
Nothing here, Captain. Must be coming from outside.
Damage control.
Yes, sir?
Is radiation penetrating the lead field?
Haven't found anything yet, sir.
Well, keep at it. Paulison, how are you doing?
I've got a fix, Captain.
Now, what is it?
I'll have to check my figures.
Oh, hurry up.
The angle is coming.
Come on, man, for Pete's sake. What's the radiation from?
It's coming from inside the ship.
That's impossible.
Well, sir, I checked it twice.
Well, it's got to be the engines.
If it is, we're finished.
Engine room.
Yes, sir.
That radiation must be in the overdrive pile.
No, sir. It isn't here, sir.
Are you, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right, keep checking. Well, only one thing left to do. Paulison, get a Geiger counter. We're going to start combing this ship inch by inch.
Yes, sir.
Turn it on.
Yes, sir.
Ready, Captain. We'll check the atomic guns first. Come on. We'll put
through the office quarters to ordnance.
Yes, sir.
Through here.
Wait a minute, sir.
Huh? What is it?
Signal is weaker now.
Yeah. Let's go back. Hold it, hold it. Seems strongest right about here.
Doesn't make sense.
Whose cabin is this?
Lieutenant Collier.
Collier!
Oh, he's down in nav control, sir.
Well, drive the door.
It's not locked, sir.
This is in here, all right. Listen to that counter.
It's strongest over here.
Open that wall cabinet.
It's locked, sir.
I'll smash it. Cut off the Geiger counter.
Well, what do you make of this, Paulison?
Well, it looks like some sort of portable transmitter, sir. Must be foreign manufacture. I don't recognize the calibration symbols at all. I've never seen anything like it.
Which raises a small question. What is Lieutenant Collier doing with a transmitter in his cabin?
I don't know, sir.
Well, I intend to find out, Paulison. Get down to nav control and bring Collier up to the bridge on the double.
Then we better find some way to shut this thing off first.
I know a way. Lieutenant Collier, I'm going to ask a few simple questions.
Yes, sir.
And I want a few simple answers.
Yes, sir.
What were you doing with the transmitter in your cabin?
Transmitter, Captain.
You know nothing about it?
No, sir, I don't.
Do you recognize these calibration symbols?
No, sir.
Can you think of how it might have been placed in your cabin without your knowing it?
No, sir, unless someone came in while I was on duty.
Well, would that have been possible?
Well, I suppose so. Well, someone had a key.
I found your cabin door unlocked.
I meant a key to the wall cabinet.
I didn't say the wall cabinet.
Oh, what? Well, sir,
You what, Lieutenant? How could you have known it was in the wall cabinet?
Well, I just assumed.
Lieutenant Collier, I find it hard to believe you would lie. Having known and respected your father and having observed the way you handled your job. However, I intend to get to the root of this thing. May I have your wristwatch, Lieutenant?
Sir?
Your wristwatch.
Here you are, sir.
Paulison, turn on that Geiger counter.
Yes, sir.
Now hold this watch next to it.
Yes, sir.
That's all. Lieutenant, if you hadn't any close contact with that transmitter, how do you explain the radioactivity of this watch?
I don't, sir.
I think you'd better. To whom were you sending those signals?
Condition red. Condition red.
There's your answer, Captain.
What is this, Collier?
Alien spaceship approaching. Alien spaceship approaching.
Collier! Who's aboard that ship? All right, now talk.
Very well, Captain. My mission seems complete.
Your mission? Are you admitting that you're an agent of a foreign power?
I am stating it.
What nation?
No nation, Captain.
What?
I am an agent of the Voltan government.
The what?
The government of the planet of Voltan.
Are you crazy?
Are you so stupid that you think your people are the only ones who can invade another planet?
Lieutenant, what do you mean?
We've had agents operating on Earth since 1945.
I don't believe you.
What do you think happened to those five ships, Captain? Where do you suppose we got our information?
Well,
your language, your culture, family background.
Your appearance, you look like...
Like Commander Collier? Is that so surprising, Captain? We had a living model.
I ought to kill you.
That would be very foolish, Captain. I would advise you to surrender without delay.
Alien ship now coming into ordnance range.
I'll deal with you later, Collier. Paulison.
Yes, sir.
Put this man in irons and take him away.
Don't worry, sir. We'll take good care of him.
Thunder, Rudson!
Gunnery.
Gunnery, Richardson.
What's the range?
10,000 meters. They're closing fast.
What's your guns on radar tracking?
Tracking. Coming on the bearing.
Fire. Fire, Richardson. Did you hear me? Fire! What's the matter down there? Did you hear me? Richardson, answer me!
What? Who? It's no use to shout, Captain.
Collier. How did you get loose? Where's Paulison?
Lieutenant Paulison is dead.
All stations, Lieutenant Collier has escaped. Seize him, men!
Don't waste your breath, Captain. Your men can't hear you.
What?
Those still alive are my men.
You're lying.
No, Captain. Every ship that has ever left Earth was controlled by a Voltaire crew.
That's impossible. Those were hand-picked men.
Hand-picked by us.
I don't believe you.
Then why not call for help?
Carpenter! Robinson! Daly! Report! Carpenter! Robinson! Daly! Report.
You see, Captain, it is quite useless. The Star Cloud will be taken to Volta for, shall we say, further experimentation.
I see. Of course, there's one thing you haven't counted on.
And just what is that, Captain?
This room. Are you in there, Lieutenant Carpenter? Well, they can't all be dead. There must be one alive. Smitty! Dr. Smithson! Smitty! Oh, Smitty. What have they done to you?
Lois.
Those dirty. Don't talk.
I must think closer. Not much time. Lois, space blues.
Space blues? What is it, Smitty? What are you trying to tell me?
All men with space blues. Voltan.
Here, let me help you.
No, Lewis. Get message back to Earth. Voltan, fifth column. Watch out for space blues.
Smitty.
Captain Thorson. Captain Thorson. You can't hide from us now. Come back to the bridge and surrender. Or my men will come and get you.
Oh, yeah?
Captain Thorson.
Hello. Star Cloud calling Earth. Please, God, let me through before it's too late. Hello. Star Cloud to Earth. Come in, please. Come in, please. Hello? Skipper, is that you? It's coming in a little louder now, Skip. Keep sending.
Thank God, Charlie. Now listen to me. Not much time. Get word to Colonel Harris. Crew mutinied. Most of crew members, Voltan.
What?
Voltan.
Spell that.
V-O-L-T.
Voltan?
That's right. That's on the planet Voltan.
Skipper, are you all right?
I'm sorry. This is serious. They'll be 30 seconds. Now listen. They have a fifth column on Earth. They're planning to invade you.
I don't mean it. I get you. Captain? Captain? Captain Thorson? Hello? Hello, Star Cloud? Come in.
What's trouble, Sergeant?
I was just trying to raise the Star Cloud, Colonel.
Had any luck?
No, sir. No contact.
No contact?
No, sir.
Nearly an hour since they hit the galactic barrier. I don't understand why they haven't tried to get a message back.
No, sir. Neither do I.
All right. I'll take over for a while.
Yes. You do that. You go right ahead, sir.
Right. Oh, Charlie, you'd better go out and get yourself some coffee. You look a little blue around the gills.
Just heard No Contact, an adventure in time, space, and the unknown. The world of...
Dimension!
Dimension X has presented No Contact, an original story written by George Lefferts from a storyline by Lefferts and Ernest Kinoy. Featured in the cast were Louis Van Ruten as Captain Thorson, Donald Bucher as Lieutenant Collier, and Cameron Prudhomme as Charlie. Your host was Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman, engineer Bill Chambers. Dimension X is produced by William Welch and directed by Edward King.
Oh, okay. We're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
Lorexo Waterless Hand Cleaner really cleans up for us. Just a dab. Removes paint, grease, tar, carbon, ink, even plain dirt. Anytime, anywhere, without water. The whole crew swears by Lorexo Waterless, and so will you.
Suspicion was a show that ran in 1935, and I haven't really succeeded in finding much detail on it other than that. They had a clever idea. Each week, they would tell not quite 15 minutes, there were such things as commercials, even in those days, but they would tell actually about a 13-minute story, always some kind of mystery. And somewhere in the story, they would always make sure that there was a prominent clue. Not usually more than one, after all. I mean, you can only do so much in 13 minutes. Then they'd ask you to come back next week. Actually, they said, come back for the next episode, where they would reveal who done it. Well, clever idea or not, I'm not going to ask you to wait until I get around to running another episode of Suspicion. These days, they got the handy-dandy editing machines.
What made me first suspect Joe was that he knew more than any innocent person should have known.
I suspected Irene the moment I heard the fireman's testimony.
The apparently unimportant fact.
I suspected the postman after he testified.
I suspected.
Listen to radio's newest, most interesting and thrilling program, Suspicion.
To keep your dog in top condition, get your pet complete nutrition. Feed them sturdy, make them sturdy, happy, friendly, peppy, furry. Any dog can be a winner if he eats some sturdy dinner. Feed them sturdy, beefy sturdy, vet with thanks, insist on sturdy. Ask any dog who's tasted it, the doggy with the bit. Use sturdy dinner, dog food is delicious. Get sturdy.
And now, Suspicion. Somewhere in the drama about to be presented is a seemingly unimportant fact, a hidden clue that first casts suspicion on the ultimate culprit. Listen regularly to this thrilling series. Test your powers of observation and deduction and find the hidden clue. It may be a single line, a sound, perhaps a complete scene. All names and characters depicted in this story are fictitious. Any resemblance to persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. And now we present Formula for Death. Late one Friday evening in March, in a small house on the outskirts of a large city in Wisconsin, Lenore Hewson is awakened by the muffled sound of a shot. Leaving her room, she runs along the darkened hallway, then down a short flight of stairs to the basement. A pale yellow light shines from under the door of her father's laboratory. Pressing her ear against the panel, she hears...
You don't talk and talk quick, Hewson. I tell you, it
isn't here.
Where is it?
I don't know.
Good beating up, and you'll talk all right, Hewson. We want your invention, and we'll get it at any cost. Jim, maybe a little arm twisting will help. Get busy.
Police, come to 137 Meadow Avenue at once. Some people have broken into the house, and... Yes, hurry. 13...
That'll take care of you, sister. That's Graham. She's tipped off the law.
Nasty crack on the head, but she'll be around in a minute.
Where am I?
In the living room of your home, Miss Hewson. We found you by the telephone in the hall.
Where's my father? No,
he was pretty badly beaten up, Miss Hewson. Now then, what happened here tonight?
I don't know.
Well, but surely you must have some idea, Miss Hewson.
Yes, but... Yes, Father, I'm here.
Lenore, don't tell anyone except George Huntley. Tell the police nothing. Nothing at all.
Yes.
They mustn't know. Tell George...
Yes, Father.
Tell George they tried to get my...
Oh, what's he talking about, Miss Hewson?
I don't know.
But you...
I tell you, I don't know.
Very well, Miss Hewson. I'm Captain Lewis of the Detective Bureau. If you find out or even have a hunch what this is all about, get in touch with me.
I have no idea why my father was attacked, Captain Lewis. sorry to break into your office this way, George.
That's quite all right, Lenore. How's your father?
Haven't you heard?
Oh, you mean here?
Yes, an hour ago.
Do you mind telling me how the accident happened last
accident.
Night?
Accident? Accident? He was murdered.
But in the papers...
Oh, I saw the story in the papers. Our father was injured during an experiment. You know who controls the papers in this city.
Now, see here, Lenore.
George, last night some men broke into the house and threatened to beat up my father unless he gave them something.
Do the police know?
Oh, yes, of course they do, but I didn't tell them everything.
Huh?
Just before father was taken to the hospital, he ordered me not to tell anyone except you. He said, tell George they tried to get my... And then he fainted. I know they were after one of his inventions, but which one? Do you know, George?
Perhaps it might be connected with an envelope he gave me last week.
Oh.
He asked me to keep it in my office safe. Did he warn you of anything, Lenore?
No. Although earlier in the week, on Tuesday, he seemed quite upset after two men had called on him. He said they were agents of Robert Blankton, the international munitions king. And he controls the newspapers in this city.
Robert Blankton, eh?
Mm.
That war maker. Perhaps we'll find the answer in this.
Oh. Well, what is it, George?
Why, it's the formula for a new gunpowder. He writes, with a gun barrel of proper strength, this powder will hurl a shell weighing 3 tons, a distance of no less than 90 miles.
Oh.
He underlined this part. I have told no one of this invention. Under no circumstances is this formula to be given to any person but Howard Kentwell of the United States Department of War.
Howard Kentwell? Father was going to fly to Washington this morning to see him.
We'll get in touch with him at once then, because Blankton and his agents won't stop at... Hello, operator. Rush this call through to the War Department at Washington, D.C. It's quite important. I don't know how Blankton learned of the invention, but sooner or later he'll find out that we have... War Department? Mr. Howard Kentwell, please. George Huntley speaking. What's that? Oh, but there must be some way of reaching him. No, I can't discuss it with anyone else. If you'll... Very well.
Isn't there?
No, and can't be reached until Monday morning.
Oh, that's almost 2 days, George. What do we do?
Well, there's only one thing, Lenore. You stay with me and my wife over the weekend at our summer home. You mustn't be left alone. Did you notice that car?
The one that just passed?
Yes. It's followed us all the way from my office in the city. If there had been less traffic on the highway...
You're not going to leave the formula here with the police, George.
Oh, not exactly, my dear. But for once, the police may be very useful.
What's this all about, George? My husband gets home much later than usual and has a...
And has a very beautiful young lady with him. The daughter of one of my late clients.
Oh.
Don't tell me you're jealous, Mary.
No, of course not. But what's the secret between you two? Why is Miss Houston here?
Oh, believe me, Mary, I can't tell you. Some unscrupulous people are after a paper I have.
Oh, well, then get rid of it. Throw it in the fire. Do something.
If the paper I have was mine, if it did belong to me alone, I think I would destroy it.
Early the following morning, Sunday...
There's another one behind the lilac tree. Do you see him?
Yes. He's been there ever since dawn this morning. I doubt if they'll attack for a while yet. And the village police promised to stop by here before noon.
Won't you change your mind about my plan to run through?
Oh, you wouldn't have a chance. No one would.
I'll try it anyway, George. If it hadn't been for me, you and Mrs. Huntley wouldn't...
Lenore, I wouldn't be alive if it hadn't been for your father.
What's that?
Your father saved my life at the risk of his own. It was during the World War. That was before your time.
Oh, what happened?
Let's not talk about it. We who actually fought, we know that the tinsel of war glory tarnishes very easily. If only everyone had been at the front. If only they could have faced death instead of...
George, I've never heard you talk like this before.
I'm sorry. I just can't help feeling that way sometimes. I guess I'm out of step with the rest of the world, Lenore.
Oh,
but in a few years, others will feel the way I do, perhaps.
Well, what do you mean?
The formula. Your father's formula for a new gunpowder capable of hurling shells over 90 miles.
George, look, they're leaving. And there's a police car coming up the road.
I wonder if...
Howard Kentwell must have heard about father's formula.
And he's come here for it, eh?
Of course. Don't you see, George? The police probably told the Federal Bureau of Investigation about father.
Will you let them in, Lenore? I'll get the formula.
Righto. You don't know how glad I'll be to get rid of it.
Yes, Miss Hewson, we're pretty certain we know who killed your father.
Who?
Oh, I've been ordered not to say anything, miss. We turned all information over to the FBI, and it's up to them. Oh, good morning. George Huntley, aren't you?
Yes. Are you Howard Kentwell?
No, I'm just an undersecretary in the department. Mr. Kentwell sent me here for Mr. Hewson's gunpowder formula. Now, here's a receipt if you just sign here.
But Mr. Hewson's wish was that it be given to no one but Mr. Kentwell.
Oh, I see. Well, suppose you fly to Washington with us and give it to him. Okay?
Certainly. I'll be ready in a minute.
These men are secret agents, Mr. Huntley.
Not taking any chances, eh?
Oh, no, we never do.
Lay off the gab and come across at the formula.
Oh, but I told you...
Give us the formula before we get rough, Huntley.
Yeah, you might fall out of the plane.
Oh, accidentally, of course.
So you men work for Robert Blankton, eh?
You catch on fast, buddy.
And you murdered Paul Hewson.
That's about it. He had something our boss wanted. It's too bad that such a brilliant man had to be mussed up, but he was stubborn.
Just a moment. You know what these are.
Take it easy, pal. Them hand grenades are...
I've taken the safety catches out. And the moment I let go of the lever...
Look out, you fool. We'll all be killed.
Certainly. All six...
Toss them bombs out of the window or I'll plug you.
Shut up. Listen... I was pretty sure all the time that you didn't belong to the War Department.
But you can't...
I didn't think you'd try anything as storybookish as this, but I had to find out. However, I had another reason for coming with you. You see, this gunpowder formula will bring death to many innocent people. I don't think anyone should have it. Certainly not an international munitions king and war maker. Perhaps not even my own country. Killing soldiers is an essential part of war. But the murder of innocent civilians? No, gentlemen. It is far better that we six and the formula be destroyed.
Ladies and gentlemen, did you discover the hidden clue that caused George Huntley to suspect the man who came for the gunpowder formula? If you did, write into this station and tell us the hidden clue. And to check your powers of observation and deduction, listen for the correct hidden clue of this story the next time we present Suspicion.
Well, don't worry about that. You see, I'm a cheat, and we're a time tourist. Here's the relevant part from next week's show.
Do you remember the scene? George Huntley has just opened a letter left by Paul Hewson.
What is it?
The formula for a new gunpowder. He writes... With a gun barrel of proper strength, this powder will hurl a shell weighing 3 tons, a distance of no less than 90 miles. He underlined this part. I have told no one of this invention. Under no circumstances is this formula to be given to any person but Howard Kentwell of the United States Department of War.
George Huntley phoned the War Department, but did not speak to Howard Kentwell. He told no one of the formula. Yet the following morning, supposed agents of the War Department asked George Huntley for the formula. That was the hidden clue, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, okay, that's it. That's another Night Transmissions in the can. Well, almost in the can. And before I go, I'm going to give you my email address in hopes that somebody will write me. If you so dispose, I'm available at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can also drop by the website. There's a contact button there. Oh, the website, as you might expect, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Whenever you're dealing with anything on the internet and night transmissions. www.nighttransmissions.com. There, I said it. See ya.
They lived together in one house. Hi-di-lum, come feel. Hi-di-lum, come farum, farum through the town of Ramsey. Hi-di-lum, come over the lea. Hi-di-lum, come feel. The tailor thought his mouse would die. Hi-di-lum, come feel. So he baked him in a banana pie. Hi-di-lum, come feel. Hi-di-lum, come farum, farum through the town of Ramsey. Hi-di-lum, come over the lea. Hi-di-lum, come feel. When the pie was cut, the mouse ran out. Hi diddlum come feel. The tailor chased him round about. Hi diddlum come feel. Hi diddlum come farum farum through the town of Ramsey. Hi diddlum come over the lea. Hi diddlum come feel. The mouse ran here, the mouse ran there. Hi diddlum come feel. He ran until he fell downstairs. Hi diddlum come feel. Hi diddlum come farum farum through the town of Ramsey. Hi diddlum come over the lea. Hi diddlum come feel. Tailor saw his mouse was dead. Hi diddlum come feel. So he bought him another one in instead. Hi diddlum come feel. Hi diddlum come farum farum through the town of Ramsey. Hi diddlum come over the lea. Hi diddlum come feel.
My son John was tall and slim, and I had a leg for every limb. But now he's got no legs at all, for he ran a race with a cannonball with me Rudanda. Father Riddle now, whack Father Riddle with me Rudanda. Oh, were you deaf or were you blind when you left your two fine legs behind? Or was it sailing on the sea? Were your two fine legs right down to your knee with me Rudanda? Father Riddle now, whack Father Riddle with me Rudanda. I was not deaf, I was not blind when I left my two fine legs behind. Nor was it sailing on the sea, wore me two fine legs right down to me knee with me Rudanda. Father Riddle now, whack Father Riddle with me Rudanda. For I was tall, I was slim, I had a leg for every limb. But now I've got no legs at all, they were both shut away by the cannonball with me Rudanda. Father Riddle now, whack Father Riddle with me Rudanda, with me Rudanda. Father Riddle now, whack Father Riddle with me Rudanda.
Words its tail hung. And word is up to Madam the Queen, and that is the worst of all, that Mary Hamilton's born a babe to the highest steward of all. Down then stepped the good old queen, gowed tassels in her hair. Oh, Mary, where's the bonny wee babe that I heard Greetsy say? I put it in a piner pig and set it on the sea. I bade it sink or it might swim, it should never come home to me. Oh, rise, Mary Hamilton, oh, rise and go with me. There is a wedding in Edinburgh town, this day we'll go and see. She put not on her black clothing, she put not on her brown, but she put on the glistering gold to shine through Edinburgh town. As they came through the cannon gate, the city for to see, the bailie's wife and the provost's wife said, "Och and alas for thee." "Gie ne'er alas for me," she said, "gie ne'er alas for me. It's all for the sake of my poor babe, this death that I must die. Cast off my gown," she says, "but let my petticoat be. And tie a napkin o'er my face, for that gallows I down see. Last night there were four Marys, tonight there'll be but three. There was Mary Beaton and Mary Seaton and Mary Carmichael and me."
There's a port on a western bay, and it serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk about their homes. And there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say, "Brandy, fetch another round." She serves them whiskey and wine. The sailors say, "Brandy, you're a fine girl. A braided chain made of finest silver from the north of Spain, a locket that bears the name of a man that Brandy loved. He came on a summer's day bringing gifts from far away, but it made it clear he couldn't stay. No harbor was his home. The sailor said, "Brandy, raging glory, but
a silent town and loves a man who's not around. She still can hear him say, she hears him say, Brandy, you're a fine girl.
I went shopping today for jewels. Wind rushed around in the dirty town, and the children let out from the school. Standing on a noisy corner, I was waiting for the walking green. Across the street he stood and he played real good on his clarinet for free. In those velvet curtain calls, I got a black limousine and 16 gentlemen escorting me to these halls. Some kind of friend to me, but the one man band by the quick lunch stand, he was playing real good for free. Stopped to hear him, though he played so sweet and high. They knew he'd never been on their TV, so they passed his good music. For a song, maybe put on some kind of harmony. I heard his refrain as that signal changed. He was playing real good and free.